This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. In a 5-4 ruling on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that use of the drug midazolam can be used in executions by lethal injection. The case stems from the botched execution of death row inmate Clayton Lockett last spring in Oklahoma, in which the drug apparently failed to render Lockett unconscious before two other drugs were administered to cause what some believe was a painful death. In arguing Glossop versus Gross, attorneys for three death row inmates said use of midazolam breached an inmate's right to his or her Eighth Amendment protection from cruel and unusual punishment. However, the majority, in an opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito, found that prisoners seeking to block the use of midazolam failed to show the government overlooked a more humane method of carrying out capital punishment. Joining us for the first part of this hour to talk about the decision is Megan McCracken. She's the Eighth Amendment Resource Counsel with the UC Berkeley School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic, where she provides litigation support and expert consultation to attorneys who are challenging lethal injection practices. Welcome, Megan.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
So is this the decision you were expecting?
The decision is not a big surprise. Legally speaking, the decision is very similar to the decision the Supreme Court announced 7 years ago in a case called Bays v. Reese. And so although the court sort of massages the facts, Justice Sotomayor says they contorted the facts of the case in order to make it fit Bays, what they are saying about the law and about the Eighth Amendment is really a retread of what they said in Bays. So in that sense, no, not particularly surprising, certainly disappointing.
So Justice Alito, in writing for the majority, says the prisoners fail to identify a known and available alternative method of execution that entails a lesser risk of pain. It sounds as if he's saying with execution, there might well be the risk of pain. Is this how you read that?
He explicitly says so, yes. He says that there's no way to remove all risk of pain, and he compares it to, you know, the death that every person faces. He says something to the effect of, we all hope to die a painless death, but we don't all get to have that. And so it's an unreasonable expectation for executions, which is certainly a big statement, you know, because there is a difference, obviously, between reaching natural death at the end of one's life versus a planned, premeditated, you know, action taken by the state, where they have the opportunity and the responsibility to plan an execution that complies with the Constitution and with the laws.
So with the Eighth Amendment, though, does it guarantee that there will be no pain whatsoever?
I'm sorry, I missed your question. It cut out for a second.
Oh, sorry about that. So with the Eighth Amendment, should there be no pain whatsoever? Is there a guarantee in cruel and unusual punishment that there is no pain whatsoever?
The Eighth Amendment protects against a substantial risk of harm. And so, no, there cannot be a guarantee of no pain. The court has talked about pain that is attendant to the loss of life. There also is always the potential for unexpected happenings. And so what the Eighth Amendment protects against is a substantial risk of pain. And what the petitioners in this case were arguing to the court is that this drug, the one drug that was at issue, is called midazolam. And in an execution, midazolam is called upon to put prisoners under anesthesia, the type of anesthesia you would need for a surgery, because the rest of the execution procedure is painful. And so it must put prisoners under what's called surgical anesthesia so that they are unresponsive to painful stimuli. And midazolam is not an anesthetic drug. It's a sedative and an anti-anxiety drug. And so the point of this case was that this drug cannot reliably protect against that pain. So it's really not a matter of, will this procedure eliminate all pain? What's at issue here is that this procedure puts prisoners at risk, creates the risk that they will be conscious and experiencing the pain and the conscious paralysis, which is caused by the second and third drugs. Mm.
Megan McCracken, if you would tell us about, just briefly, about how the use of midazolam came into being in these cases.
Sure. So the first time we saw midazolam used in an execution procedure was in Ohio. Well, that's the first time we saw it in a written protocol. And there, Ohio was addressing a problem of setting IVs in its prisoners. And so it started to use, or at least have on its books, the option of an injection for execution, a big shot. And there they would use a combination of midazolam and hydromorphone. Once states saw midazolam in Ohio's protocol, other states started using it and putting it into different drug combinations. And so Florida started using it in this three-drug procedure, which was the procedure contemplated in this new decision. Oklahoma started using it. Ohio used it in that two-drug formula. Arizona has used it in a two-drug formula. And so really, it just sort of bubbled up from a specific need in Ohio to address IV problems, and then started to be used in a small number of states.
And it was being used because barbiturates, which had been used, were no longer available.
Sort of.
I can clarify that if you would, Megan.
Sure. Please. One barbiturate, sodium thiopental, which used to be the drug used as the first drug in executions, that drug is no longer available. And it's no longer available to anyone for any use in this country. So hospitals, doctors, departments of corrections, everyone. Then departments of corrections, because they simply could not get thiopental, they started to use a drug called pentobarbital, which is also a barbiturate and an anesthetic. That drug is manufactured in this country by only one company, and that company chose to make its product unavailable for executions. They didn't want to be associated with that use, and so the pentobarbital remains available, fully available for medical use, but the pharmaceutical company chose to make it unavailable for executions. Today, we see some states continuing to use pentobarbital anyway because they're able to get it from compounding pharmacies. And then other states have switched to midazolam, which is this sedative drug.
How would you characterize this decision as it affects the opponents of the death penalty and the movement to abolish the death penalty?
I think the immediate implications of this decision are certainly that we will see states like Oklahoma and Florida resume executions. Those are the two states that have been using midazolam in this three-drug procedure. Executions have been on hold there because of the Supreme Court case. So those two states will be able to resume executions. Other states that have not been using midazolam, it's likely or at least possible that other states will change their execution procedures to start using midazolam. You know, so that's sort of the practical implications of the decision. We have seen at least three very problematic, highly bungled or botched executions using midazolam, and so a possibility or a likelihood is that we will see more bad executions as midazolam is more widely used.
So briefly, Megan, when you say these were bungled, what happens to the condemned person?
Well, there have been three executions where the condemned prisoner was not immediately paralyzed after midazolam was administered. And in all three of those executions, the prisoner continued to breathe, struggle, show signs of distress and suffering, and continue to breathe and live for much longer than anticipated, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and in one case, almost 2 hours. So that's what we have seen. In all other executions, 13 other executions using midazolam, the prisoner was paralyzed immediately after administration of the drug, so it is not possible to know whether those prisoners experienced similar problems during the execution.
Justice Breyer wrote a dissent which called for a review of whether the death penalty itself violates the Constitution, saying it was, quote, highly likely that the death penalty violates the Eighth Amendment. So when a justice calls for review, what happens next?
Well, I mean, certainly now he is on record expressing his doubts about the death penalty in a larger sense. But, you know, in terms of what happens next, not necessarily anything. You know, we really don't know.
I guess my question is, does this open the door to the court taking cases that challenge the constitutionality of the death penalty?
They certainly can at any time, sure. And it lets us know that when problems with the death penalty are exposed, when people begin to see what is going on behind the scenes, the problems, the real issues, it makes them question the entire enterprise. And whether the issue is lethal injection or cost or deterrence or innocence or prosecutorial misconduct, the more people know, the more they begin to question the entire enterprise.
Most developed countries no longer have the death penalty. Why do you think it is still a part of the legal process in the United States?
Well, I'm afraid that is beyond my purview. You know, it's a state-by-state legal question in our country, and so many states have turned away from the use of the death penalty and have abolished the death penalty in their states. Use of the death penalty is certainly declining, but each state makes that decision for its own laws, and so, you know, it's sort of a chopped-up process in that regard.
And worth noting, too, in Pennsylvania, a few months ago, Governor Wolf announced he would suspend the death penalty and issue reprieves for the executions that had been scheduled. And Philadelphia DA Seth Williams has sued. So if I had to ask you, Megan McCracken, you know, if you took a look 10 years down the road with what you know as part of the movement to abolish the death penalty, where do you think this will head? Do you see the death penalty still being a part of the American legal system in 10 years?
I mean, what I see
with this deeply divided Supreme Court.
Right. We clearly have a deeply divided Supreme Court. We have four justices who wholly reject the majority opinion yesterday and say that the court had to contort the facts to reach their conclusions. We see Justice Breyer coming out with serious doubts about the death penalty. And I think that as we learn more and as we present more and more of the facts that are behind the death penalty, that it will cause more people to question its use. I am not a reader of tea leaves, so I can't say what will happen in 10 years. But I do know that we have a lot of issues that demonstrate a lot of problems with it.
Megan McCracken, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Megan is the Eighth Amendment Resource Counsel with the UC Berkeley School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic. After the break, we talk about the historic Supreme Court decision legalizing gay marriage. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. On May 17, 2004, Marsha Kadish and Tanya McCloskey became the first same-sex couple to be married in the nation, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In the 11 years since, social change has moved with almost astonishing swiftness. As of last Thursday, 36 states recognized gay marriage. And then Friday, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, determined that gay couples have the constitutional right under the 14th Amendment to marry in all 50 states. For the remainder of the hour, we talk about this groundbreaking decision by the Supreme Court and what's next for gay civil rights and for opponents of same-sex marriage. Lenore Carpenter is Associate Professor of Law at Temple University Beasley School of Law, and she joins us in studio. Welcome, Lenore.
Thanks a lot.
And joining us by phone is Tobias Barrington Wolf, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Tobias also served as the chief advisor and spokesperson on LGBT issues for Barack Obama throughout his 2007-2008 campaign. Hello, Tobias.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Sure, welcome to Radio Times. So let's look first at the 5-4 decision, another deeply divided court, liberal justices on one side in favor of gay marriage as a constitutional and protected right, conservative on the other, Justice Kennedy in the middle as the swing vote. Lenore, first to you, any surprises here to you in the decision and the split?
Well, I think in terms of the split, I'm not at all surprised by that, and I don't think most people are. So no real surprises in how this fell out for me.
Tobias?
I'll tell you, the thing that I find the most surprising about the decision is the dissenting opinions. And there's a lot to say. We can talk about it over the course of the program. But one of the things that I think it's always incumbent upon any judge to do is to explain his or her reasoning and to explain a desired outcome in terms of the real lives of the people whose claims are in front of the court and in terms of the real impact that mistreatment or discrimination has on a group of people. And the most striking thing about these dissenting opinions, all four of the justices in dissent wrote their own dissenting opinions. Not a single one of those opinions spends any time actually talking about the same-sex couples who are being discriminated against in the marriage laws of so many states. And I find it remarkable that they didn't take responsibility for explaining why the harms that these couples were suffering were somehow permissible or justified under the Constitution. That was a surprise to me.
You know, let's get to, we're going to get to Justice Kennedy's opinion in just a moment. But Tobias, since you brought it up, Chief Justice John Roberts said, and shortening this, but these are his words, "By all means, celebrate today's decision, but do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it." What was he saying here? Lee?
Well, the Chief Justice wrote a pretty patronizing opinion, it must be said. And, you know, in one passage, he was invoking a bunch of cultures from around the world and from millennia past, the Han Dynasty Chinese and the Kalahari Bushmen and so forth, a bunch of people whom I dare say he doesn't know the first thing about. And then he turned to the claimants before the court and basically said, sure, have fun celebrating your victory, but don't think that this really means anything. And I must say, I found the Chief Justice's opinion quite out of character and really quite disappointing analytically, and I think that that passage was part and parcel of the approach that he took to his opinion.
Lee Carpenter, some might interpret that as Robert saying, well, this was legislated from the bench. And in some things that I had read, it seemed more that he was pushing for the current trend of state by state, legislating gay marriage.
Right. And I think that was the thrust of the Chief Justice's dissent, was to say, you know, well, things have been going so well for you. Why not just allow this process to carry forward? Things have been going so well for you in state courts. Things have been going well for you legislatively. Why not just allow that process to go forward? And I think what he said at the end about the Constitution having nothing to do with it was really, you know, sort of a jab in the direction of this is not part of, you know, the democratic process as he understands it. But I completely agree with Tobias. I think that dissent was almost like it was in a vacuum. It didn't comprehend or even try to grapple with the real lived experiences of not only the litigants in these particular cases that came up through the Sixth Circuit, but also all of the litigants or all the people who are similarly situated to those litigants. It just fundamentally ignored the fact that there are real people experiencing real harms today who may live in states where, you know, that democratic process might never come for them. So I agree. And I think that his opinion was perhaps an attempt to provide some sort of a more pleasant kind of counterweight to Scalia's dissent. But I do think that it came off as being out of touch, potentially, and perhaps, as Tobias said, somewhat patronizing. Mm.
Let's go to Justice Kennedy, who, in the opinion for the majority, wrote of couples challenging state bans on same-sex marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it, meaning marriage, respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. So what was he saying in his decision with respect to the 14th Amendment, Lee?
Well, I think that what Kennedy's whole line of, you know, of cases has largely been about with respect to the rights of LGBT people. He's got this continuing focus on the idea of dignity, on the idea that the Constitution protects a person's basic agency to behave as they will, to live their life as they wish in dignity. And I think that that's very characteristic of the way in which Kennedy has treated LGBT rights opinions in the past. So it seems characteristic to me.
Tobias Wolff, worth noting, Justice Kennedy was appointed by Ronald Reagan and quite often leans to the right.
Well, that's certainly true. And it's actually a measure of how conservative the present Supreme Court is in most respects that Justice Kennedy, who has very progressive jurisprudence in one or two select areas, of which this is one, has been identified as the great sort of savior of progressive values on this court. He is, in many respects, a very conservative justice. There's no question.
Yeah, and I'd like to add that although this is sort of characterized as a victory for progressives, I think that the way that the opinion is written could actually be seen as a champion, sort of a championing of a very kind of a conservative way of looking at gay rights. This is an opinion that is very much grounded in the importance of marriage as an institution, the importance of child rearing, of monogamy, of the sort of these noble, I think he may use the word noble at some point, this, you know, this sort of noble process of committing yourself to another person. That is one view of LGBT rights that is, that's, you know, that conservatives can kind of get behind. There has always been another undercurrent in the LGBT rights movement about liberation, about being able to be different, not having to assimilate. That was much more characteristic of the earlier part of the LGBT rights movement in the 1970s, post-Stonewall, the idea of sexual liberation. You don't see any of that in any of Kennedy's opinions about LGBT rights. So although you can see this as a victory for a cause that has been championed by progressives, it's not necessarily a progressively written opinion, if that makes any sense.
We're looking at the U.S. Supreme Court decision regarding gay marriage. Our lines are open, 888-477-9499, if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. Tobias, how did the decision address the children of gay parents? What was Kennedy's argument in this regard?
Well, this is an issue that Justice Kennedy was very concerned with in the Defense of Marriage Act case from 2 years ago, and then again, I think clearly in this case. And, you know, what was at stake here? What was at stake in laws that excluded same-sex couples from not just marriage, but from the entire apparatus of family law in many regards, had in part to do with citizenship status and dignity. It had in part to do with the question of whether your government is treating you as though you're some kind of lesser human being in comparison to your fellow citizens. And then it has in part to do with very practical questions about what your rights are and the way in which you can provide for your partner or for your kids in times of crisis, the ways in which the state will help you when a marriage ends or when a relationship ends. The dissolution of a relationship is a point in time when people often need protection and a structure to make sure that everybody's rights are safeguarded. And Justice Kennedy talked about both of those dimensions of the issue, specifically with reference to kids. And he talked about, in his majority opinion, the harm that kids suffer when they're told by the government that somehow their parents and their family is less worthy than other people's families. And he also talked about the practical harm that kids can experience when those very, you know, concrete and tangible rights are denied to them simply because their parents are gay instead of straight.
Okay. Justice Kennedy, by the way, seemed to be offering up an olive branch to the other side when he wrote in his opinion, "Many who deem same-sex marriage to be wrong reach that conclusion based on decent and honorable religious or philosophical premises." And he goes on to say, "Neither they nor their beliefs are disparaged here." Lee Carpenter, how do you read this? How do you read that line?
Well, I read that line in sort of two dimensions. One is sort of a foreshadowing of what's ahead, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. You know, and I think you're right. I think the other is an attempt to perhaps provide some counterpoint to some of the things that have been said in conservative media and perhaps by other Supreme Court justices about what this means, about, you know, whether it means that folks who have religious objections to same-sex marriage are now to be completely silenced. That is what they have been told. People across the United States who have religious objections to same-sex marriage have been told a lot of things that are at least largely, in my opinion, unlikely to come about. You know, things like your priest is going to have to marry same-sex couples, or your church will be sued. I mean, things like that. I think Kennedy is trying to speak to that, trying to make it appear that he is not trying to undercut folks' religious values, because he's not. Right? But also maybe to answer some of that rhetoric that religious people who have these kinds of objections have heard.
Tobias, what do you think?
I think a lot of that is correct. And just to eliminate any possible doubt, since this is one of the areas where opponents of LGBT equality often try to sow confusion, it is 100% clear that religious officiants, pastors, priests, are never going to have to perform religious wedding ceremonies that they don't want to. They have a constitutional right to define their own religious doctrine as they see fit. And the attempts by opponents to confuse that issue have been really rather dishonest. But more broadly, I think it's a feature of many civil rights issues that at the time that a principle of equality gets established for a group, for a population for the first time, there are a lot of people who resist it. And there are a lot of people who resist it for reasons having to do with their culture, their religious belief, their upbringing. And they're not bad people. Many people who opposed integration when Brown versus Board of Education was decided were not what we would look at today as, you know, bad to the core racists. They were people who had been brought up in a tradition and in a culture, and then that tradition and culture was turned on its head. And that was unequivocally necessary and the right thing to do in terms of defining constitutional values. But it also really disrupted people's lives in ways that they took some time to figure out. And I think it's reasonable to acknowledge that that's a process that happens anytime we vindicate constitutional rights for a group that has previously been marginalized.
Looking down the road, Tobias, the path outside the church door is probably the path that is thorny, the path at the bakery, the path at the caterers. Do you think Justice Kennedy was in an oblique way referencing that? What's going to happen down the road?
Well,
probably likely happen down the road in terms of movement ahead.
Yeah, I think he may have been acknowledging that that's a place for future discussion. And when we're talking about the terms on which people enter the public marketplace, or to be sure, the terms on which people come to government offices and interface with their government, we're already seeing attempts by some states to write discrimination into the terms of their government offices. The Attorney General of Texas just the other day issued an opinion in which he purported to say that when you come to the window of a county clerk's office or when you come to a justice of the peace, you can be told by a government official who's paid by your tax dollars, "I don't take people like you, go to another window because I have religious objections to you and your relationship." And that's, I think, a really distressing idea. And we are going to have to confront efforts along those lines in some states. We're already seeing it.
Do you think that'll pass constitutional muster, Lee?
Well, in terms of government officials, yeah. I think that that's a tough one. But I think that the bigger question is going to be religious exemptions being written into anti-discrimination laws that cover private actors. For me, and I think, Tobias, you may agree with me on this, that that's something that opponents of same-sex marriage have sort of been gearing up to do and have been doing, in some measure for some years, and are probably going to do to try to achieve much more robustly now that same-sex marriage, is actually the law of the land. We're going to be seeing, I think, a huge push to have very wide exemptions for religious beliefs, or maybe not even necessarily religious beliefs. I'm not sure how some folks might want to write this legislation into anti-discrimination laws, so that folks don't have to serve, gay married couples, or maybe even LGBT people at all. Tobias, I don't know if you'd like to.
Yeah, Tobias, you want to carry that thread of thought?
No, it's quite correct that this is going to be a major issue. And one of the cases that got a fair amount of attention I've talked about on your program before that I was lead counsel on was the New Mexico wedding photography business that turned away my client, a lesbian, and her partner who were looking for photographic services. And this is going to be a huge issue. It already is in legislatures around the country. One of the odd facts about this debate is that some of the states that are clamoring the most loudly to say we're going to write exemptions into our anti-discrimination laws, they don't have anti-discrimination laws that cover LGBT people in the first place. So we both need to be having a conversation about the fact that same-sex couples around the country now have the right to get married. And in many states, if you get married and come into work the next day and say, I've gotten married, the response might be, great, you're fired.
All right. We'll pick up that thread in just a moment. Our subject for the remainder of the hour is the historic U.S. Supreme Court decision Friday legalizing gay marriage. Stay with us. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times, and I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Our guests this hour are Tobias Barrington Wolf, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Lee Carpenter is associate professor of law at Temple University Beasley School of Law. We are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court decision Friday legalizing gay marriage in all 50 states. Telephone number to call if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499, and we've got some calls stacking up. We'll get to those in just a moment. But Lee, just going into the break, we were talking about how most states do not have anti-discrimination laws which cover gay people in place.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that one of the things that's very kind of strange about the way that everything has developed over the long term is before the same-sex marriage push really gained a lot of momentum in the early and mid-2000s, as LGBT rights advocates, we were mainly focusing on trying to get basic workplace protections in place. We were trying to get anti-discrimination laws passed. We were trying to get hate crime laws passed, you know, under the thinking that, you know, first you convince people not to beat you up, then you convince them, you know, not to fire you, and then maybe you can move on to marriage. It turns out that that's not sort of the way that this has progressed. So exactly as Tobias had said, it was something that I wanted to make sure we made clear. You actually, in most states, can now get married, come in the next day, try to sign your partner up for health benefits, like your new spouse, and have your employer fire you because you've just outed yourself as gay. And that's a very unusual position for folks to be in, and a dangerous position for many gay people, lest gay people feel that they are now safe in some way, that they are now completely sort of, you know, free to be out. That is not necessarily going to be what people find is the reality.
Let's get to the phones. Raphael in Graduate Hospital, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question was to address the institution of marriage as a whole and why it's not being discussed about more, like that it's a religious institution and the government shouldn't be involved in religious institutions in the first place. Well, you know, why is the religious concept of marriage a state problem, a federal problem? Shouldn't if there are going to be unions, shouldn't they just be civil unions? And it can be between anybody. It can be between multiple people. It can be between whoever, because it's just a legal construct, not a religious construct.
Tobias, you want to tackle that one?
The separation of church and state.
Yeah, it's certainly true that the government has no role in defining religious concepts and religious institutions for people. And of course, it's already the case that there are many religions, powerful religions in the United States that have a much more limited or exclusionary definition of what marriage is. So, for example, there are some faiths, like the Catholic faith, that say that divorce is not recognized, and therefore a marriage following a divorce is not a valid marriage. There are faiths, like some strains of the Jewish faith, that say if you marry outside your faith, then that's not a proper marriage either. And, of course, those ideas are not reflected in our laws. There's a parallel track, as it were. And so, if you ask the question, so why do we have something called civil marriage in our laws at all? Why not call it something different like civil unions or civil partnerships? I think the basic answer is because marriage is something that people understand. And that if you talk people through it a little bit, they get that there's the part of marriage which is about our laws and about your status in front of the government. And then there's the part of marriage which is about your faith for people who are part of faith traditions. And that those two things are just very separate.
Yeah, and the one thing I wanted to add was, you know, I don't mean to be the Debbie Downer of the LGBT rights movement, but you know, there are some criticisms that I have and that others have of the way that Kennedy's opinion has been written. I would have liked to have seen it focus more on those sort of more clinical kind of aspects of marriage, the government benefits and how they are were being unequally allocated. I think with all the sort of the lofty, beautiful, poetic rhetoric about marriage that Kennedy inserted into his opinion, to some degree he is not doing anything to clarify that there is a real, very real distinction between marriage as sort of this loving and quasi-religious or religious institution that's all about sort of feelings and God, and marriage as a set of very concrete benefits and obligations, but marriage as a legal scheme. So, you know, that's sort of one way in which I think that the opinion, for all of its beauty, is in some way not helping to clarify that distinction. Mm.
Raphael, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. Let's turn to Antonin Scalia and his dissent, which is perhaps even more scornful than he normally can be. He says, to allow the policy of same-sex marriage be considered and resolved by a select patrician, highly unrepresentative panel of nine, is to violate a principle even more fundamental than no taxation without representation. No social transformation without representation, regardless of the case that we're talking about. Tobias Barrington Wolf, does he have a point regarding the makeup of the Supreme Court? Is it representative of the people? Or are we talking? I mean, he points out that it's Harvard and it's Yale, and I think Sotomayor went to Princeton for a time. Is that representative of the American people, and should it be?
I have to be honest with you. I have very little to say about Justice Scalia's dissent. I think that it is a political document and not a judicial document. And I think that it was written to provoke people to ask questions like this on radio shows rather than for serious analysis. And I don't really want to give Justice Scalia the platform that he is seeking with what I think is a really quite an opinion which is quite unworthy of the position that he holds. So I think I'll leave it at that.
All right, Lee Carpenter.
Well, the one thing that I would like to add is that as a proud Temple Law graduate, I do think that we need more Temple Law graduates on the Supreme Court. So that is the one place that Scalia and I are in complete agreement.
Oh, there you go. Let's talk about the cases which laid the groundwork for this decision, United States versus Windsor, which struck down part of DOMA. And what came before that? Tobias Barrington Wolfe?
Well, the four cases in which the Supreme Court has expressly and directly recognized the rights of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, and in some of these opinions also transgender people, there's an overlap there, but also some distinctions that we shouldn't lose sight of. Those four opinions are the Romer versus Evans case, the Lawrence versus Texas case, the Windsor case, and now the Obergefell case. They're all written by Justice Kennedy over the course of the last 19 years. And they all dealt with various different aspects of singling out gay people or same-sex couples and subjecting them to discrimination. But the broader jurisprudence that Justice Kennedy draws upon in these rulings goes back many decades, and it relates both to the concept of liberty under the Due Process Clause, which has been given substantive content by the Supreme Court at various points in time, including in a line of cases that deals with reproductive autonomy, for example. And one of the things about Justice Thomas's dissent in the marriage case is that it's really an opinion which is not just about marriage for same-sex couples, but also about eradicating the entire structure of reproductive rights for women in the United States. And then the opinion also draws upon earlier rulings that deal with second-class citizenship and that deal with discrimination that imposes second-class citizenship. And so, for example, in the very first of these rulings, this case Romer versus Evans that I mentioned, Justice Kennedy in several places invoked the civil rights tradition and invokes the court's repudiation of separate but equal in the Brown versus Board of Education decision. So there are broader principles that the court has drawn upon in all of these cases.
And Lee?
Yeah, and I think that you can't really ignore the centrality of Loving versus Virginia here. Most folks probably know that that is the case.
Justice Thomas takes issue with that, by the way.
I know he does. He takes issue with a number of things. But Loving versus Virginia, I think, is really to some degree kind of a keystone to this opinion because, you know, one of the arguments against same-sex marriage is, well, you know, you have this fundamental right to marriage, but the very definition of marriage doesn't contemplate same-sex couples. And you can get drawn into kind of a circular argument about, well, you have a fundamental right to marry, but, you know, the word marry doesn't mean same-sex couples. Without Loving, you may not be able to kind of get out of that analytical loop. What Loving versus Virginia does here is it says, the fundamental right to marry is broad enough to encompass even things that citizens might not have or some citizens might not contemplate as being marriage as they know it. In fact, interracial marriage was in Virginia at the time outside of people's understanding of what marriage was. So I think that you can't ignore how central that case was. It's very interesting that it should have this kind of effect all these years later.
Back to the phones.
Yeah,
Dave?
If I could.
One more, Tobias, jump in, and then we'll get to Dave.
Sorry, very quickly.
Sure.
Lee makes a great point, and one of the issues that Justice Kennedy touches upon briefly in his opinion, and that Justice Ginsburg actually mentioned during oral argument, which I had the great good fortune to attend, is that the definition of marriage in the United States used to be entirely structured around the rights and prerogatives of men to the exclusion of the rights and prerogatives of women, and that part of what informs the court's decision is an understanding that once you get rid of those sex hierarchies in marriage, then the idea of defining who gets to marry in terms of the sex of the people involved in the relationship just no longer makes any sense. And that comes very directly from Loving versus Virginia, which the court properly said recognize that white supremacy was the principle that underlay a lot of the anti-miscegenation laws.
Okay. Dave in Booth Wynn, Pennsylvania, you're live on Radio Times. Hello, Dave.
Good morning. Good morning. I appreciate your show and the opportunity to weigh in. There's one thing that I'm not hearing covered in everybody's discussion with regards to the same-sex marriage issue. It seems to me that a lot of the opponents to same-sex marriage are quoting their religious aspects, and I'm not going to classify these people as being conservative or liberal because it really doesn't matter with regards to my point. My point is it seems that a lot of the opponents, as I said before, seem to be quoting what their perception of the Bible or whatever, you know, let's just stick with the Bible, seems to teach them as far as how to approach, you know, the traditional ideas of marriage. It would also seem to me that these same people are going to be the first ones that support one of the original tenets upon which this country was founded, which was freedom of religion. Ergo, it would seem to me that if these people are opposing same-sex marriage based upon their interpretation of religion, why cannot these same people also allow a little bit of latitude based upon the corresponding belief that the country was founded on freedom of religion, to just let it go and you know, let the LGBT community do what they wish to do?
Interesting thought, Dave. And, you know, if anybody, we don't have a whole lot of time this hour, but if anybody thinks along those lines and you want to give us a quick call at 888-477-9499, please feel free to do so. Lee, did you want to jump in there? Okay. We're going to get to, and thank you very much for the call, Dave. I did want to get to the GOP presidential field, which is split over the Supreme Court ruling. Ted Cruz, of course, came out swinging. Mike Huckabee called it judicial activism. Rick Perry said the decision should be made at the state level. Jeb Bush said time to move on in wake of the decision and says he doesn't think a constitutional amendment on same-sex marriage is realistic, which is what the conservative movement was pushing for. Lindsey Graham offered an olive branch. Tobias Barrington Wolf, were you surprised at that?
Well, I think that I'm not surprised by anything that I see coming out of the field of Republican candidates for the presidency at this point. And Ted Cruz is actually an interesting example of part of what Dave, our last caller, was just talking about. He was asked in an interview the other day about the religious basis of the objections that many people had to interracial marriage or to the elimination of Jim Crow and the desegregation of our public institutions. And Ted Cruz is a very educated man. He went to Harvard Law School. He clerked for the Chief Justice of the United States. He is an advocate before the Supreme Court. And he just refused to acknowledge that in past decades, religious belief has been used to justify white supremacy. And he knows that history, and he, I think, just was being willfully dishonest in the way that he approached the question. And so we're seeing quite a range of rhetoric and quite a range of, I think, sometimes rather dishonest arguments coming out of some of these political figures. And I think the ones who are offering something that looks more like an olive branch are recognizing that, you know, nastiness really doesn't play very well in a political campaign.
Lee?
Yeah, I mean, you know, primaries are primaries, right? And you know, you have a group of people, all of whom are trying to read the tea leaves and do some math and try to figure out how they can get the nomination. And they're each playing to what they believe their base to be. You know, whether or not Ted Cruz actually cares about same-sex marriage is almost irrelevant. You know, how these people actually think about the LGBT community is almost irrelevant to the things that they will say, I think. And I don't mean to sound sort of exceptionally jaded about our political process, but you have to understand that these guys are trying to, you know, add up the votes to get the primary endorsement or to win the primary election. And once they do, they often sort of switch positions, move back to the center. You know, so it's all math, really.
So very quickly, we only have about 40 seconds left. Lee, were you surprised at the swift societal change of the last decade?
I
have 2004 to 2015?
I was. I really was. When I started, you know, doing this work in 1999, 2000, as I think I've said, nobody really thought that, you know, in any reasonable way that at this point in history we would have national same-sex marriage. It's a pretty amazing time.
Tobias, your thoughts in about 15 seconds?
I'll say, I think that fundamentally this is about recognizing the equal humanity of your family members and your neighbors. And I think that that is a force that over time becomes irresistible.
Tobias Barrington Wolf, it was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Tobias is professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Lenora Carpenter, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much, Mary.
Lenora is associate professor of law at Temple University Beasley School of Law. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Hour two is just ahead.